even when they're not eating more calories than they're expending, even when half-starved, as Jean Mayer said. As I pointed out earlier, this phrase alone makes it possible to explain the existence of obese women with starving children in impoverished societies. In one sense, however, Wertheimer was exaggerating to make his point, because the nutritional state of the animal, as Wertheimer knew, does indeed influence the balance of mobilization and deposition, whether more fat is going in than is coming out, or vice versa. Over the course of any 24-hour period, fat from your fat cells will provide a significant portion of the fuel that your cells will burn for energy. The reason nutritionists like to think and like to tell us that carbohydrates are somehow the preferred fuel for the body, which is simply wrong, is that your cells will burn carbohydrates before they'll burn fat. They do so because that's how the body keeps blood sugar levels in check after a meal. And if you're eating a carbohydrate-rich diet, as most people do, your cells will have a lot of carbohydrates to burn before they get to the fat. Imagine that you're eating a meal that contains both carbohydrates and fat, which most meals do. As the fat is digested, it's shipped off directly to the fat cells for storage. Think of it as being set aside temporarily while the body deals with the carbohydrates, which demand more immediate action. As these carbohydrates are digested, they appear in the bloodstream in the form of glucose, which is the sugar in blood sugar. A carbohydrate called fructose is a special case, and I'll discuss that later. Cells throughout the body will burn this glucose for fuel and use it to replenish their backup fuel supplies. But they can't keep up with the rising tide of blood sugar unless they get help doing it. This is where the hormone insulin comes in. Insulin plays many roles in the human body, but one critical role is to keep blood sugar under control. You'll start secreting insulin from the pancreas even before you start eating. Indeed, it's stimulated just by thinking about eating. This is a Pavlovian response. It will happen without any conscious thought. In effect, this insulin is preparing your body for the meal you're about to eat. When you take your first bites, more insulin will be secreted. And as the glucose from the meal begins flooding the circulation, still more is secreted. The insulin then signals cells throughout the body to increase the rate at which they're pumping in glucose from the bloodstream. The cells, as I said earlier, will burn some of this glucose for immediate energy and store some for later use. Muscle cells store the glucose in the form of a molecule called glycogen. Liver cells store some as glycogen and convert some to fat. And fat cells store it as fat. As your blood sugar begins to decrease, and insulin levels decrease along with it, more and more of the fat stored during the meal will be released from fat tissue, or at least it should be, to take up the slack. Some of this fat begins life as carbohydrates, and some began life as fat in the diet, but it's indistinguishable once it finds itself stored in the fat cells. The more time passes after a meal, the more fat you will burn, and the less glucose. The reason you can sleep through the night without getting up every few hours to raid the refrigerator, or the reason you should be able to, is that fat flowing out of your fat tissue keeps your cells nicely fueled until the morning. So the correct way to think about fat tissue is that it's more like a wallet than a savings or retirement account. You're always putting fat into it, and you're always taking fat out. You get a tiny bit fatter. More fat goes into our fat cells than comes out during and after every meal. And then you get a tiny bit leaner again. The opposite occurs after the meal is digested. And you get leaner still while sleeping. In an ideal world, one in which you're not getting any fatter, the calories you store as fat immediately after meals during the day are balanced out over time by the calories you burn as fat after digesting those meals and during the night. Another way to think of this is that your fat cells work as energy buffers. They provide a place to put the calories that you consumed during a meal and don't use immediately, and then they release the calories back into the circulation as you need them. Just as your wallet provides a place to put the money you withdraw from the ATM and then releases it, so to speak, as you need it throughout the day. It's only when the reserves of fat are reduced to some minimum amount that you start to get hungry again and are motivated to eat. Just as we all have some minimum amount of cash we like to have in our wallets, and when we get down to that point, we go to the bank machine and restock. In the early 1960s, the Swiss physiologist Albert Reynold, who followed Ernst Wertheimer as the preeminent scientist in the field of fat metabolism, put it this way. "Our fat tissue," he wrote, "is the major site of active regulation of energy storage and mobilization, one of the primary control mechanisms responsible for the survival of any given organism." The fact that fat is flowing into and out of our fat cells all day long, though, doesn't explain how the cells decide what fat gets to come and go and what fat has no choice and is locked away inside. This decision is made very simply, based on the form of the fat. The fat in our bodies exists in two different forms that serve entirely different purposes. Fat flows in and out of cells in the form of molecules called fatty acids. This is also the form we burn for fuel. We store fat in the form of molecules called triglycerides, which are composed of three fatty acids, tri, bound together by a molecule of glycerol, glyceride. The reason for this role distribution is again surprisingly simple. Triglycerides are too big to flow through the membranes that surround every fat cell, whereas fatty acids are small enough to slip through cell membranes with relative ease, and so they do. Flowing back and forth, in and out of fat cells all day long, they can be burned for fuel whenever needed. Triglycerides are the form in which fat is fixed inside fat cells, stashed away for future use. For this reason, the triglycerides first have to be constructed inside a fat cell, the technical term is esterified, from their component fatty acids, which is what happens. When a fatty acid flows into a fat cell, or when it's created in the fat cell from scratch out of glucose, it will be bound up with a glycerol molecule and two other fatty acids, and the result is a triglyceride, a molecule now too big to get out of the fat cell. Now these three fatty acids are stuck in the fat cell until the triglyceride gets disassembled or falls apart, and they can flow out of the fat cell again and back into the circulation. Anyone who ever bought a piece of furniture only to realize that it's too big to fit through the door of the room for which it was intended knows the routine. You take the furniture apart, if possible. You walk the pieces through the door, and then you put the item of furniture back together on the other side. And if you move and you want to take this particular furniture with you to your new home, you repeat the process in the other direction. As a result, anything that works to promote the flow of fatty acids into your fat cells, where they can be bundled together into triglycerides, works to store fat, to make you fatter. Anything that works to break down those triglycerides into their component fatty acids, so the fatty acids can escape from the fat cells, works to make you leaner. As I said, it's pretty simple. And as Edwin Astwood pointed out half a century ago, there are dozens of hormones and enzymes that play a role in these processes, and it's very easy to imagine how they can be disturbed so that too much fat gets in and not enough gets out. One hormone dominates this action, though, and that's insulin. Astwood pointed this out almost 50 years ago, and it's never been controversial. As I said, you secrete insulin primarily in response to the carbohydrates in your diet, and you do so primarily to keep blood sugar under control. Insulin is also secreted when we eat protein-rich foods, but the action is far more measured than it is for carbohydrates, and it depends in large part on the carbohydrate content of the meal. As a result, it's carbohydrates that effectively determine insulin secretion. But the insulin also works simultaneously to orchestrate the storage and use of fat and protein. It makes sure, for instance, that your muscle cells get enough protein to do whatever rebuilding and repair is necessary. And it makes sure that you store enough fuel, glycogen and fat and protein as well, to function effectively between meals. And because one place we store fuels for later use is our fat tissue, insulin is the principal regulator of fat metabolism, which is how it was described in 1965 by Solomon Burson and Rosalind Yalow, the two scientists who invented the technology necessary to measure hormone levels in our blood and did much of the relevant research. Yalow later won the Nobel Prize for this work. Burson certainly would have shared it had he not died before the prize was awarded. Insulin accomplishes this job primarily through two enzymes. The first is LPL, lipoprotein lipase, the enzyme I discussed earlier when we were talking about how rats get obese if their ovaries are removed. LPL is the enzyme that sticks out from the membranes of different cells and then pulls fat out of the bloodstream and into the cells. If the LPL is on the surface of a muscle cell, then it directs the fat into the muscle to be used for fuel. If it's on a fat cell, then it makes that fat cell fatter. The LPL breaks down triglycerides in the bloodstream into their component fatty acids, and then the fatty acids flow into the cell. As I said previously, the female sex hormone estrogen stifles the activity of LPL on fat cells and so works to decrease fat accumulation. LPL is the simple answer to many of the questions I raised earlier about the wheres and whens of fattening. Why do men and women fatten differently? Because the distribution of LPL is different, as is the influence of sex hormones on LPL. In men, LPL activity is higher in the fat tissue of the gut, so this is where men tend to get fat, whereas it's low in the fat tissue below the waist. One reason men get fatter above the waist as they age is that they secrete less testosterone, a male sex hormone, and testosterone suppresses LPL activity on the abdominal fat cells. Less testosterone means more LPL activity on the fat cells of the gut, and so, more fat. In women, the activity of LPL is high on the fat cells below the waist, which is why they tend to fatten around the hips and butt, and low on the fat cells of the gut. After menopause, the LPL activity in women's abdominal fat catches up to that of men, and so they tend to put on excess fat there, too. When women get pregnant, LPL activity increases on their butts and hips. This is where they store the calories they'll need later to nurse their babies. Putting fat on below the waist and behind them also balances the weight of the child growing in their womb in front. After women give birth, the LPL activity below their waist decreases. They lose the excess fat they gained, at least most of it, but LPL activity increases in the mammary glands of their breasts, so they can use this fat to produce milk for the baby. LPL also happens to be one very good answer to the question of why we don't lose fat when we exercise. While we're working out, LPL activity decreases on our fat cells and increases on muscle cells. This prompts the release of fat from our fat tissue, so we can burn it in our muscle cells, which need the fuel. We get a little leaner. So far, so good. But when we're done exercising, the situation reverses. Now LPL activity on the muscle cells shuts down. LPL activity on the fat cells shoots up, and the fat cells restock whatever fat they lost during the workout. We get fatter again. This also explains why exercise makes us hungry. Not only do our muscles crave protein after a workout to restock and rebuild, but our fat is actively restocking too. The rest of the body tries to compensate for this energy drain, and our appetite increases. Since insulin is the primary regulator of fat metabolism, it's not surprising that it's the primary regulator of LPL activity. Insulin activates LPL on fat cells, particularly the fat cells of the abdomen. It upregulates LPL, as researchers say. The more insulin we secrete, the more active the LPL on the fat cells, and the more fat is diverted from the bloodstream into the fat cells to be stored. Insulin also happens to suppress LPL activity on the muscle cells, assuring that they won't have many fatty acids to burn. Insulin also tells muscle cells and others in the body not to burn fatty acids, but to continue burning up blood sugar instead. This means that when fatty acids do escape from a fat cell, if insulin levels happen to be high, these fatty acids won't be taken up by the muscle cells and used for fuel. They'll end up back in the fat tissue. Here is a technical description from the 2008 edition of Williams' textbook of endocrinology. Insulin influences the partitioning of triglycerides among different body tissues through its stimulation of LPL activity in adipose tissue. Insulin also influences an enzyme that we haven't discussed, hormone-sensitive lipase, or HSL for short. And this may be even more critical to how insulin regulates the amount of fat we store. Just as LPL works to make fat cells, and us, fatter, HSL works to make fat cells, and us, leaner. It does so by working inside the fat cells to break down triglycerides into their component fatty acids, so that those fatty acids can then escape into the circulation. The more active this HSL, the more fat we liberate and can burn for fuel, and the less, obviously, we store. Insulin also suppresses this enzyme, HSL, and so it prevents triglycerides from being broken down inside the fat cells and keeps the outward flow of fatty acids from the fat cells to a minimum. And it takes just a little bit of insulin to accomplish this feat of shutting down HSL and trapping fat in our fat cells. When insulin levels are elevated, even a little, fat accumulates in the fat cells. Insulin also turns on a mechanism in the fat cells to pump in glucose, just as it does in muscle cells, and this increases the amount of glucose the fat cells metabolize. This in turn increases the amount of glycerol molecules, a byproduct of glucose metabolism, floating around in the fat cells. And these glycerol molecules can now be bundled together with fatty acids into triglycerides, and so more fat can be stored. To assure we have room to store all that fat, insulin also works to create new fat cells in case the ones we already have are getting full. And insulin signals liver cells not to burn fatty acids, but to repackage them into triglycerides and ship them back to the fat tissue. It even triggers the conversion of carbohydrates directly into fatty acids in the liver and in the fat tissue. Although how much this actually goes on in humans, as opposed to lab rats, is still a subject of debate. In short, everything insulin does in this context works to increase the fat we store and decrease the fat we burn. Insulin works to make us fatter. The next photo in the enhanced file for this audiobook shows a particularly graphic example of this fattening effect of insulin, courtesy of the textbook Endocrinology, An Integrated Approach by Stephen Nusley and Saffron Whitehead, which the National Library of Medicine makes available online. http://www.ncbi.nlm.nih.gov/BOOKSHELF/BR.FCGI?BOOKEN The caption of this photo is "The Effects of Insulin on Adipose Tissue." The woman pictured here developed type 1 diabetes when she was 17. The photo was taken 47 years later. In the intervening years, she faithfully injected herself with her daily insulin in the same two sites on her thighs. The result? Cantaloupe-sized masses of fat on each thigh. And these obviously have nothing to do with how much she ate, only the fattening or lipogenic effect of the insulin. Keep in mind that it took this woman decades to amass these unsightly fat deposits. For her, it would have seemed barely noticeable year to year, just as it does for many of us when we get fat. When we raise insulin levels throughout our body, this is what happens. This is why diabetics often get fatter when they take insulin therapy. It results from the direct lipogenic effect of insulin on adipose tissue, independent of food intake, as explained by the seminal textbook in the field, Joslin's Diabetes Mellitus. In one study published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2008, type 2 diabetics on intensive insulin therapy gained an average of 8 pounds, and almost one in every three of these diabetics gained more than 20 pounds in 3.5 years. Because the insulin level in the bloodstream is determined primarily by the carbohydrates that are consumed, their quantity and quality, as I'll discuss, it's those carbohydrates that ultimately determine how much fat we accumulate. Here's the chain of events. 1. You think about eating a meal containing carbohydrates. 2. You begin secreting insulin. 3. The insulin signals the fat cells to shut down the release of fatty acids by inhibiting HSL and take up more fatty acids via LPL from the circulation. 4. You start to get hungry or hungrier. 5. You begin eating. 6. You secrete more insulin. 7. The carbohydrates are digested and enter the circulation as glucose, causing blood sugar levels to rise. Once again, this doesn't include fructose, a special case as I will soon discuss. 8. You secrete still more insulin. 9. Fat from the diet is stored as triglycerides in the fat cells, as are some of the carbohydrates that are converted into fat in the liver. 10. The fat cells get fatter, and so do you. 11. The fat stays in the fat cells until the insulin level drops. If you're wondering whether any other hormones make us fat, the answer is effectively no, with one significant exception. A hormone discovered in the late 1980s known as acylation-stimulating protein is almost assuredly an insignificant exception. It is secreted by the fat tissue itself, a process that is regulated at least in part by insulin. One way to think about what hormones do is that they instruct the body to do something, grow and develop growth hormones, reproduce, sex hormones, flee or fight, adrenaline. They also make the fuel available for those various actions. Among other things, they signal our fat tissue to mobilize fatty acids and make them available for fuel. For example, we secrete adrenaline in response to perceived threats. It readies us to flee or fight should the need arise. But if you had to flee a charging lion, say, and you didn't have the fuel immediately available to run either faster or farther, and maybe both, than the lion would catch you. So on seeing the lion, you secrete adrenaline, and the adrenaline, among other things, signals your fat tissue to dump fatty acids into the circulation. These fatty acids, ideally, will then provide all the fuel you need to make your escape. In this sense, every hormone but insulin works to release fat from our fat tissue. They make us leaner, at least temporarily. These other hormones, though, have a far more difficult time getting fat out of fat tissue if the insulin level in the circulation is elevated. Insulin trumps the effects of other hormones. It's all very rational. If there's a lot of insulin around, it should mean there are also a lot of carbohydrates around to burn, that the blood sugar level is high, and so we don't need or want fatty acids getting in the way. As a result, these other hormones will liberate fat from the fat tissue only when insulin levels are low. The other hormones work by stimulating HSL to break down triglycerides. But HSL is so sensitive to insulin that the other hormones can't overcome its action. The one meaningful exception is cortisol. This is the hormone we secrete in response to stress or anxiety. Cortisol actually works to put fat into our fat tissue and to get it out. It puts fat in by stimulating the enzyme LPL, just as insulin does, and by causing or exacerbating a condition known as insulin resistance, which I'll discuss in the next chapter. Once you're insulin resistant, you secrete more insulin and you store more fat. So cortisol makes us store fat both directly through LPL and indirectly through insulin. But then it works to release fat from our fat cells, primarily by stimulating HSL, just like other hormones. So cortisol can make us fatter still when insulin is elevated, but it can also make us leaner, just like every other hormone, when insulin levels are low. And this may explain why some people get fatter when they get stressed, anxious, or depressed and eat more, and some people do the opposite. The bottom line is something that's been known and mostly ignored for over 40 years. The one thing we absolutely have to do if we want to get leaner, if we want to get fat out of our fat tissue and burn it, is to lower our insulin levels and to secrete less insulin to begin with. Here's how Yalow and Burson phrased it back in 1965. Releasing fat from our fat tissue and then burning it for energy, they wrote, requires only the negative stimulus of insulin deficiency. If we can get our insulin levels to drop sufficiently low, the negative stimulus of insulin deficiency, we can burn our fat. If we can't, we won't. When we secrete insulin, or if the level of insulin in our blood is abnormally elevated, we'll accumulate fat in the fat tissue. That's what the science tells us. The implications. Earlier, I talked about the 24-hour cycle of storing and burning fat. We gain it during the day when we're digesting meals because of the effects of carbohydrates on insulin. We lose it in the hours until our next meal and at night while we're sleeping. Ideally, the fat we gain during the fat storage phases is balanced by the fat we lose during the fat burning phases. What we gain during the day is burned during the night, and it's insulin that ultimately controls this cycle. As I've said, when insulin levels go up, we store fat. When they come down, we mobilize the fat and use it for fuel. This suggests that anything that makes us secrete more insulin than nature intended, or keeps insulin levels elevated for longer than nature intended, will extend the periods during which we store fat and shorten the periods when we burn it. As we know, the imbalance that results, more stored fat, less burned, can border on infinitesimal, 20 calories a day, and it can lead us to obesity within a couple of decades. In 1984, a brilliant French physiologist named Jacques Lemonnier described the situation this way. It is not a paradox, he wrote, to say that animals and humans that become obese gain weight because they are no longer able to lose weight. By extending the periods when we're storing fat rather than burning it, insulin indirectly has another effect. Remember, we depend on fatty acids for fuel in the hours after a meal, as blood sugar levels are dropping to their pre-meal level. But the insulin suppresses the flow of fatty acid from the fat cells. It tells the other cells in the body to burn carbohydrates. So, as blood sugar returns to a healthy level, we need a replacement fuel supply. If insulin remains elevated, the fat isn't available, nor is protein, which our cells can also use for fuel if necessary. Insulin also works to keep protein stored away in the muscles. We can't use the carbohydrates we've stored in the liver and muscle tissue either, because the insulin keeps that supply locked up as well. As a result, the cells find themselves starved for fuel, and we quite literally feel their hunger. Either we eat sooner than we otherwise would have, or we eat more when we do eat, or both. As I said earlier, anything that makes us fatter will make us overeat in the process. That's what insulin does. Meanwhile, our bodies are getting bigger because we're putting on fat, and so our fuel requirements are increasing. When we get fatter, we also add muscle to support that fat. Thanks again in part to insulin, which assures that whatever protein we consume is used for repairing muscle cells and organs and for adding muscle if necessary. So, as we fatten, our energy demand increases, and our appetite will increase for this reason as well, particularly our appetite for carbohydrates, because this is the only nutrient our cells will burn for fuel when insulin is elevated. This is a vicious cycle, and it's precisely what we'd like to avoid. If we're predisposed to get fat, we'll be driven to crave precisely those carbohydrate-rich foods that make us fat. Chapter 12. Why I get fat and you don't, or vice versa. If insulin makes people fat, why does it make only some of us fat? We all secrete insulin, after all, and yet plenty of us are lean and will stay lean for life. This is a question of nature, our genetic predisposition, not nurture or the aspects of diet and/or lifestyle that trigger this nature. The answer lies in the fact that hormones don't work in a vacuum, and insulin is no exception. The effect of a hormone on any particular tissue or cell depends on a host of factors, both inside and outside cells, on enzymes, for instance, such as LPL and HSL. This allows hormones to differ in their effect from cell to cell, tissue to tissue, and even at different stages of our development and our lives. One way to think about insulin in this context is as a hormone that determines how fuels are partitioned around the body. After a meal, insulin and the various enzymes it influences, such as LPL, determine what proportion of the different nutrients will be sent to which tissues, how much will be burned, how much will be stored, and how this will change with need and with time. Since I'm concerned here with whether fuels will be used for energy or stored, imagine insulin and these enzymes as determining which way the needle points on what I'm going to call a fuel partitioning gauge. Imagine it looking like the fuel gauge in your car, but instead of the F standing for full on the right, it stands for fat, and the E on the left doesn't stand for empty, but for energy. If the needle points to the right, toward the F, it means that insulin partitions a disproportionate amount of the calories you consume into storage as fat, rather than use for energy by the muscles. In this case, you'll have a tendency to fatten, and you'll have less energy available for physical activity, so you'll also tend to be sedentary. The farther the needle points toward fat storage, the more calories will be stored, the fatter you'll be. If you don't want to be sedentary, of course, then you have to eat more to compensate for this loss of calories into fat. To be precise, the insulin stashes fat in the fat tissue and assures that it stays there. Our muscles are forced to burn more carbohydrates to compensate, and we deplete our reserves of glycogen, which alone might make us hungrier. The result is that we want to eat more and expend less, while our fat tissue just keeps filling up with fat. It's the morbidly obese people of the world who live on the far end of this side of the gauge. When the needle points in the other direction, toward the E, you'll be burning as fuel a disproportionate share of the calories you consume. You'll have plenty of energy for physical activity, but little will be stored as fat. You'll be lean and active, just as you're supposed to be, and you'll eat in moderation. The farther out you go in this direction, the more energy you'll have for physical activity and the less will be stored, the leaner you'll be. Emaciated-looking marathoners can be found down here. Their bodies burn calories, they don't store them, and so these people literally have energy to burn. They have what pre-World War II metabolism researchers would have called a very powerful impulse to be physically active. What determines the direction in which the needle points? The answer is not quite as simple as how much insulin you secrete, although that's probably part of it. Given the same food containing the same amount of carbohydrates, some people will secrete more insulin than others, and those who do are likely to put on more fat and have less energy. Their bodies work to keep blood sugar levels under control, because high blood sugar is toxic, and they're willing to overstuff their fat cells if necessary to do it. But another important factor is just how sensitive to insulin your cells happen to be, and how quickly they become insensitive, the property called insulin resistance, in response to the insulin you secrete. This idea of being resistant to insulin is absolutely critical to understanding the reasons we get fat, and also many of the diseases associated with it. I'll return to it frequently. The more insulin you secrete, the more likely it is that your cells and tissues will become resistant to that insulin. That means it will take more insulin to do the same glucose disposal job, keeping blood sugar under control. One way to think about it is that your cells make the decision that they don't want any more glucose than they're already getting. Too much glucose is toxic for cells, too. So they make it harder for insulin to do its job and get the glucose out of the bloodstream. The problem, or the solution, depending on point of view, is that the pancreas responds by pumping out still more insulin, and the result is a vicious cycle. When a lot of insulin is secreted in response to easily digestible carbohydrates, say, your cells are likely to resist the effects of that insulin, at least in the short term, particularly your muscle cells, because they're getting enough glucose already. If these cells become resistant to insulin, more insulin is required to keep blood sugar levels in check. So now you secrete more insulin, which prompts more insulin resistance. All the while, that insulin is working to make you fatter, to store calories as fat, unless your fat cells are also resistant to it. So secreting more insulin will move the needle on the fuel partitioning gauge towards storage. But if you secrete a healthy amount of insulin, and yet your muscle tissue is relatively quick to become resistant to that insulin, you'll achieve the same thing. You'll secrete more insulin in response to the insulin resistance, and you'll grow fatter. The third factor is that your cells will respond differently to insulin. Fat cells, muscle cells, liver cells don't all become resistant to insulin at the same time, to the same extent, or in the same way. Some of these cells will become more or less sensitive to insulin than others, which means the same amount of insulin will have a greater or lesser effect on different tissues. And how these tissues respond will differ as well, from person to person and, as I'll discuss, over time in the same individual. The more sensitive a particular tissue is to insulin, the more glucose it will take up when insulin is secreted. If it's muscle, it will store more glucose as glycogen and burn more for fuel. If it's fat, it will store more fat and release less. So if your muscle cells are very sensitive to insulin and your fat cells less so, then the needle of the fuel partitioning gauge points toward fuel burning. Your muscles will take up a disproportionate share of the glucose from the carbohydrates you consume, and they'll use it for energy. The result? You'll be lean and physically active. If your muscles are relatively insensitive to insulin compared with your fat cells, then your fat tissue will be the repository of a disproportionate share of the calories you consume. As a result, you'll be fat and sedentary. The effect of making particular tissues insulin resistant can be mimicked in laboratory mice and has been by researchers at the Joslin Diabetes Center in Boston. They created mice that lack what are called insulin receptors on different tissues, which means those tissues are completely resistant to insulin. As we'd expect, mice that lack insulin receptors on their muscle cells but not on their fat cells get obese. The animals partition glucose into the fat for storage, not the muscles for energy. Mice that lack insulin receptors on their fat cells are lean, and they stay lean, even when they're force-fed more food than they'd otherwise prefer to eat. Here's another complication. How your tissues respond to insulin changes will change with time, and in response to your diet, as I'll discuss shortly. As you get older, you get more insulin resistant. But this almost invariably happens to your muscle tissue first, and only later, if at all, to your fat tissue. As a general rule, fat cells always stay more sensitive to insulin than muscle cells do. So even if you're lean and active when you're young, with your fuel partitioning needle pointing toward fuel burning, your muscle cells are likely to become resistant to insulin as you get older. As they do, you'll respond by secreting more insulin. This means the needle on the fuel partitioning gauge will move to the right as you age. More and more calories will be diverted into fat, leaving fewer and fewer available to fuel the rest of the body. As you enter middle age, you'll find it increasingly difficult to remain lean. You'll also begin to manifest a multitude of other metabolic disturbances that accompany this insulin resistance and the elevated insulin levels that go hand in hand. Your blood pressure goes up, as does your triglyceride level. Your HDL cholesterol, aka the good cholesterol, goes down. You become glucose intolerant, which means you have trouble controlling your blood sugar, and so on. And you'll become increasingly sedentary, a side effect of the energy drain into the fat tissue. In fact, the conventional wisdom that those of us who fatten as we move into middle age do so because our metabolism slows down probably has this cause and effect backward. More likely is that our muscles become increasingly resistant to insulin, and this partitions more of the energy we consume into fat, leaving less available for the cells of muscles and organs to use for fuel. These cells now generate less energy, and this is what we mean when we say that our metabolism slows down. Our metabolic rate decreases. Once again, what appears to be a cause of fattening, the slowing of our metabolism, is really an effect. You don't get fat because your metabolism slows. Your metabolism slows because you're getting fat. Before I discuss the nurture side of this issue, the foods we eat that make things worse and that we can live without, there is one more issue of nature to discuss. Why our children are today getting fatter, and maybe even coming out of the womb fatter, than just 20 or 30 years ago. This is one aspect of the obesity epidemic that's emerged recently in studies worldwide. Not only are more children obese now than ever before, but most studies report that they're noticeably fatter at 6 months, a phenomenon that obviously has nothing to do with their behavior. Fat children tend to be born of fat parents, in part because of all the ways that our genes control our insulin secretion, the enzymes that respond to insulin, and how and when we become resistant to insulin. But there's also another factor that represents cause for concern. Children in the womb are supplied with nutrients from the mother, through the placenta and umbilical cord, in proportion to the level of those nutrients in the mother's blood. This means that the higher the level of the mother's blood sugar, the more glucose her child gets in her womb. As the pancreas in that child develops, it apparently responds to this higher dose of glucose by developing more insulin-secreting cells. So the higher the blood sugar in the pregnant mother, the more insulin-secreting cells her child will develop, and the more insulin the child will secrete as it gets close to birth. The baby will now be born with more fat, and it will have a tendency to over-secrete insulin and become insulin-resistant itself as it gets older. It will be predisposed to get fat as it ages. In animal studies, this predisposition often manifests itself only when the animal reaches its version of middle age. If this observation translates to humans, then some of us are programmed in the womb to get fat in middle age, even if we show little or no sign of this predisposition when we're young. This is almost assuredly the reason why obese mothers, diabetic mothers, mothers who gain excessive weight during pregnancy, and mothers who become diabetic in pregnancy, a condition known as gestational diabetes, all tend to have larger and fatter babies. These women tend to be insulin resistant and have high levels of blood sugar. But if fatter mothers have fatter babies, and fatter babies become fatter mothers, where does it stop? This suggests that, as the obesity epidemic took off, and we all began getting fatter, we began to program more and more of our children from the first few months of their existence to get fatter still. In fact, it wouldn't be surprising if this particular vicious cycle is one cause of the obesity epidemic. Thus, we have more than our own health to consider when we get fat. Our children, too, may pay a price, and their children. And each successive generation may find it that much harder to undo the problem. Chapter 13. What we can do. Whether you're born predisposed to get fat is beyond your control. What Adiposity 101 teaches us, though, is that this predisposition is set off by the carbohydrates we eat, by their quantity and their quality. As I said, it's carbohydrates that ultimately determines insulin secretion and insulin that drives the accumulation of body fat. Not all of us get fat when we eat carbohydrates, but for those of us who do get fat, the carbohydrates are to blame. The fewer carbohydrates we eat, the leaner we will be. A comparison with cigarettes is apt. Not every long-time smoker gets lung cancer. Only 1 in 6 men will, and 1 in 9 women. But for those who do get lung cancer, cigarette smoke is far and away the most common cause. In a world without cigarettes, lung cancer would be a rare disease, as it once was. In a world without carbohydrate-rich diets, obesity would be a rare condition as well. Not that all foods that contain carbohydrates are equally fattening. This is a crucial point. The most fattening foods are the ones that have the greatest effect on our blood sugar and insulin levels. These are the concentrated sources of carbohydrates, and particularly those that we can digest quickly. Anything made of refined flour, bread, cereals, and pasta, liquid carbohydrates, beers, fruit juices, and sodas, and starches, potatoes, rice, and corn. These foods flood the bloodstream quickly with glucose. Blood sugar shoots up, insulin shoots up. We get fatter. Not surprisingly, these foods have been considered uniquely fattening for nearly 200 years, as I'll discuss later. How our blood sugar responds to different foods is known technically as the glycemic index, a reasonably good measure of how our insulin will respond. The higher the glycemic index of a particular food, the greater the blood sugar response. Entire books have been published on the idea of minimizing the glycemic index of our diets, and by doing so, minimizing the insulin we secrete and the fat we accumulate. These foods are also, almost invariably, the cheapest calories available. This is the conspicuous explanation for why the poorer we are, the fatter we're likely to be. Why, as I discussed at the outset, it's all too easy to find extremely poor populations, past and present, with obesity and diabetes rates that rival those in the United States and Europe today. This was the explanation suggested by physicians who worked with these populations in the 1960s and 1970s, and now we know it's supported by the science. Most third world countries have a high carbohydrate intake, wrote Rolf Richards, the British-turned-Jamaican diabetes specialist in 1974. It is conceivable that the ready availability of starch in preference to animal protein, contributing as it must the main caloric requirements of these populations, leads to increased lipogenesis, fat formation, and the development of obesity. People in these populations get fat not because they eat too much or are too sedentary, but because the foods they live on, the starches and refined grains that make up the great majority of their diet, and the sugar, are literally fattening. The carbohydrates in leafy green vegetables like spinach and kale, on the other hand, are bound up with indigestible fiber and take much longer to be digested and enter our bloodstream. These vegetables contain more water and fewer digestible carbohydrates for their weight than starches like potatoes. We have to eat far more to get the same load of carbohydrates, and those carbohydrates take longer to digest. As a result, blood sugar levels remain relatively low when we eat these vegetables. They initiate a far more modest insulin response and are therefore less fattening. It is possible, though, that some people may be so sensitive to the carbohydrates in their diet that even these green vegetables may be a problem. The carbohydrates in fruits, though relatively easy to digest, are also diluted more by water, and so are less concentrated than the carbohydrates in starches. Given an apple and a potato of the same weight, the potato will have a significantly greater effect on blood sugar, which suggests that it should be more fattening. But that doesn't mean fruit won't fatten some people. What makes fruit worrisome from the perspective of Adiposity 101 is that it is sweet to the taste precisely because it contains a type of sugar known as fructose, and fructose is uniquely fattening as carbohydrates go. As nutritionists and public health authorities have become increasingly desperate in their attempts to rein in the obesity epidemic, they've also become increasingly strident in their suggestions that we eat copious fruits along with green vegetables. Fruit doesn't have to be processed before we eat it. It's fat and cholesterol-free. It has vitamins, vitamin C in particular, and antioxidants. And so, by this logic, it must be good for us. Maybe so. But if we're predisposed to put on fat, it's a good bet that most fruit will make the problem worse, not better. The very worst foods for us, almost assuredly, are indeed sugars. Sucrose, table sugar, and high fructose corn syrup in particular. Public health authorities and journalists have recently taken to attacking high fructose corn syrup as a cause of the obesity epidemic. It was introduced in 1978 and replaced the sugar in most soft drinks in the United States by the mid-1980s. Total sugar consumption, caloric sweeteners, as the Department of Agriculture calls them, to distinguish them from non-caloric artificial sweeteners, promptly increased from roughly 120 pounds per capita yearly to 150, since Americans didn't realize that high fructose corn syrup was just another form of sugar. It is, though. I'm going to refer to both of them as sugars, because they are effectively identical. Sucrose, the white granulated stuff we put in our coffee and sprinkle on our cereal, is half fructose and half glucose. High fructose corn syrup, in the form we typically get it in juices, sodas, and fruity yogurts, is 55% fructose, which is why it's known in the food industry as HFCS55, 42% glucose, and 3% other carbohydrates. It's the fructose in those sweeteners that makes them sweet, just as it makes fruit sweet, and it appears to be the fructose that makes them so fattening, and in turn, so bad for our health. The American Heart Association and other authorities have lately, better late than never, taken to targeting fructose, and thus sugar and high fructose corn syrup, as a cause of obesity, and maybe even heart disease. But they do so primarily on the basis that these sweeteners are empty calories, which means they don't come with any vitamins, minerals, or antioxidants attached. This misses the point, however. Fructose actually has unhealthy effects, including making us fat, that have little to do with its lack of vitamins or antioxidants, and far more to do with how our bodies process it. The sugary combination of roughly half fructose and half glucose might be particularly effective in making us fat. When we digest the carbohydrates and starches, they eventually enter our bloodstream as glucose. Blood sugar increases, insulin is secreted, and calories are stored as fat. When we digest sugar or high fructose corn syrup, much of the glucose ends up in the general circulation, raising our blood sugar levels. The fructose, however, is metabolized almost exclusively in the liver, which has the necessary enzymes to do it. So fructose has no immediate effect on our blood sugar and insulin levels. But the key word is immediate. It has plenty of long-term effects. The human body, and particularly the liver, never evolved to handle the kind of fructose load we get in modern diets. Fructose exists in fruits in relatively small quantities, 30 calories in a cup of blueberries, for instance. Some fruit, though, as I'll discuss later, has been bred for generations to increase its fructose content. There are 80 calories worth in a 12-ounce can of Pepsi or Coke. 12 ounces of apple juice has 85 calories of fructose. Our livers respond to this flood of fructose by turning much of it into fat and shipping it to our fat tissue. This is why even 40 years ago, biochemists referred to fructose as the most lipogenic carbohydrate. It's the one we convert to fat most readily. Meanwhile, the glucose that comes with the fructose raises blood sugar levels and stimulates insulin secretion and puts the fat cells in the mode to store whatever calories come their way, including the fat generated in the liver from the fructose. The more of these sugars we consume, and the longer we have them in our diet, the more our bodies apparently adapt by converting them to fat. Our pattern of fructose metabolism changes with time, as the British biochemist and fructose expert Peter Mays says. Not only will this cause us to accumulate fat directly in the liver, a condition known as fatty liver disease, but it apparently causes our muscle tissue to become resistant to insulin through a kind of domino effect that is triggered by the liver cell's resistance. So even though fructose has no immediate effect on blood sugar and insulin, over time, maybe a few years, it is a likely cause of insulin resistance, and thus the increased storage of calories as fat. The needle on our fuel partitioning gauge will point toward fat storage, even if it didn't start out that way. It's quite possible that if we never ate these sugars, we might never become fat or diabetic, even if the bulk of our diet were still starchy carbohydrates and flour. This would explain why some of the world's poorest populations live on carbohydrate-rich diets and don't get fat or diabetic, while others aren't so lucky. The ones that don't, or at least didn't, like the Japanese and Chinese, were the ones that traditionally ate very little sugar. Once you do start to fatten, if you want to stop the process and reverse it, these sugars have to be the first to go. Alcohol is a special case. Alcohol is metabolized mostly in the liver. Some 80% of the calories from a shot of vodka, for instance, will go straight to the liver to be converted into a small amount of energy and a large amount of a molecule called citrate. The citrate then fuels the process that makes fatty acids out of glucose. So alcohol will increase the production of fat in the liver, which probably explains alcoholic fatty liver syndrome. It might also make us fatter elsewhere, although whether we store these fats as fat or burn them might depend on whether we eat or drink carbohydrates with the alcohol, which we usually do. Roughly a third of the calories in a typical beer, for instance, come originally from maltose, a refined carbohydrate, compared with the two-thirds from the alcohol itself. A beer belly is the conspicuous result. Chapter 14. Injustice Collecting. The message of Adiposity 101 is simple enough. If you're predisposed to get fat and want to be as lean as you can be without compromising your health, you have to restrict carbohydrates and so keep your blood sugar and insulin levels low. The point to keep in mind is that you don't lose fat because you cut calories. You lose fat because you cut out the foods that make you fat, the carbohydrates. If you get down to a weight you like and then add these foods back to the diet, you'll get fat again. That only some people get fat from eating carbohydrates, just as only some get lung cancer from smoking cigarettes, doesn't change the fact that if you're one of those who do, you'll only lose fat and keep it off if you avoid the